Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Rocor versus National Union 5.
May it please the court, Page, the argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
We've always allowed 10 minutes for rebuttal, but we had this last week, and the court asked about 10 more minutes of questions, and it led to, I think, an imbalance. I believe you should open for 13 minutes at least.
I'd be glad to do whatever the court wants. The only reason I'd suggested that is we're both petitioners, so half my argument.
Well, that's true.
But
all right, this time we'll see how it works.
I'll speak more slowly on the first and quicker on the second.
No, but go ahead and just open for Tim. But last week it was a disaster.
I hope you're not saying that again next week. May it please the court. This case does present two issues relating to insurance that have been issues that the court has devoted a lot of energy to in the past few years. I'm not going to dwell on the facts other than the facts in this case so clearly establish my client Rocor's liability that no one in their right mind would try that lawsuit. Once you got in, you figured out that their driver was drunk and ran over two DPS troopers and you had widows and orphans and no effective defense, that was a case that ought to be settled. And that was Rocor's mindset and the mindset of their defense lawyer. It quickly became apparent that the $2 million in primary limits were gone, and it was going to be in National Union's layer. And National Union recognized that and took over the settlement negotiations, even to the point of canceling the mediation that had been scheduled so that National Union could get in and control things.
But there was no written offer to settle for less than $10 million after April, whatever year it was, 1990, was that the right year?
No,
1991.
There was not. We did meet the Garcia standard very clearly. There was coverage. There was a written offer to settle within policy limits. And there certainly, the jury found were circumstances that made it reasonable to accept a settlement offer.
But not the $10 million.
That's right. And that's one thing, Your Honor, that obviously takes us away from the classic Stowers case. The case did settle, and we didn't have an excess judgment, thank goodness. If the court is going to narrowly construe Stowers, then probably we're not going to fit in those requirements. And that's why really, in my first half, I'd like to talk to you more about the statute, because if I can persuade you...
Let's just assume for a minute that Stowers would cover this type of conduct, intentionally having somebody bear unnecessary expense. But Justice, I think this is Justice Heck's question, but can you lead us through where the actual demand was communicated? That showed that this settlement could have been accomplished $124,000 earlier.
I mean, absolutely.
And where is that in the record, and how much proof does it take to establish that?
Well, there clearly was a written settlement demand, so we don't have the Stowers quantity.
Yeah, but that's for $10 million.
For $10 million. I mean, that was policy limit, so that at least gets us in the zone of having a duty.
But that
can't Stowers.
Put a...
That was within the policy limits of the excess carrier.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So we don't have this problem like Maldonado where it's excess. We don't have a problem where there's not a written demand on wondering what was in the plaintiff's mind. They clearly would have settled within the policy limits. The real fact issue in this case, the jury was persuaded on, the Court of Appeals, and I don't think this court's going to be able to find no evidence, was could they have settled for the $6.4 million that they ultimately have settled for a year early?
Doesn't Garcia say you don't have to make an offer?
That's right, but Garcia
and the plaintiffs
also,
never made an offer.
Well, they did. They did. $10 million.
And well, so, but not for the $6.4 million.
Exactly, and that's one question. You've never required that before. The question is, can Stowers be adapted to this case? I believe it can because Stowers itself was a general negligence duty. Stowers itself didn't say, in these narrow circumstances, we recognize this narrow wooden point-by-point duty. Stowers said, when you have someone that is your agent and they have exclusive control, they have a duty to act reasonably, especially when they have an adverse interest.
Assuming you're right about that, why doesn't Garcia say, but you don't have to negotiate?
Well,
you don't have to make an offer.
If the court wants to say that, that would be going a little bit further than Garcia. Because as you were calling Garcia, once you decided that the policies couldn't be stacked, there never was a settlement within policy limits.
Well, in your brief, you say National Union was not required to make a settlement offer.
That's right. They didn't have to open up with a settlement offer, and Garcia is clear about that. And your rationale was clear that it's in the interest of the plaintiff to come forward. Also, that establishes causation, that if you don't accept the offer and have an excess judgment.
But you think once the plaintiffs make the $10 million offer, then National Union had an obligation to negotiate from there?
I think so. I think under general negligence principles, that's what the court should conclude.
Let me ask you a question. It was not clear to me, but the demand was within policy limits. So if Stowers applied, there's no question that Stowers kicks in.
Yes.
Now the only question is, was there negligence in failing to settle?
Yes.
Historically, that had been an that meant if you got a judgment because it didn't settle and it exceeded the policy limits, the insurance company is liable for the limits. And the facts in this case, as I understand it, the insurer had an agreement with the insured. The insured was going to bear the litigation costs.
That's right.
And your argument is that once Stowers kicked in, negligence failing to settle, the insurer was liable for the additional litigation costs the insured incurred while the insurer was refusing to respond to that offer to settle.
Exactly. And the basis for that, if Stowers is only a failure to settle that leads to an excess judgment and liability for those damages, we can't win under Stowers. That's important because in Head, this court said, we refuse to recognize the duty of good faith and fair dealing because we think insureds are fully protected by breach of contract and the Stowers duty. If you leave a gap for this kind of case and say the Stowers duty isn't broad enough to cover it, what you said in Head will be untrue.
But isn't in the typical situation where Stowers is invoked, we typically have an insurer who has by contract the duty to defend.
That's right.
Isn't that a critical distinction, and doesn't the Stowers doctrine basically, wasn't it decided with that underpinning?
That was a factor, but I respectfully disagree. I don't think that's a critical distinction in this case, and here's why. What Stowers talked about was the exclusive control that came along with the duty to defend in that case and under the ordinary liability policy. There's no question in this case that once National Union took over, they did have exclusive control of settlement to the point of they now became responsible for all negotiations. They said, Rocourt, don't get involved. So either because they had that right under their contract or because they assumed that right, one who doesn't have a duty but voluntarily assumes one, they took over. So we have the exclusive control component of Stowers. Our damages are different only because they did so. The court has never held that the excess judgment is the only kind of damages. Normally it is. It's the most common kind. But if it's a general negligence duty, it's just a question, are these foreseeable damages? And the record's replete with evidence. Rocourt saying, look, the case ought to settle. We're continuing to incur these expenses. Another concern is, well, golly, we had the duty to defend. Why shouldn't we bear that expense? In every Stowers case, the insurance company has a contractual policy limit, and in every Stowers case, you ignore that contractual right because of their negligence.
But here's what doesn't make sense, and that is the insurance company had, you contend, the ability to settle the lawsuit early on for $10 million. And then they eventually settle it for more than $3 million less. Why shouldn't they be able to have that ability to continue to negotiate to try to drive down the settlement price?
We said they had the ability early on to settle it for exactly the same amount that they
But there was no evidence that there was a demand by the plaintiff for the eventual settlement.
But there was a lot of evidence, Your Honor, in writing as well. There was contemporaneous correspondence from May of 1990, that time frame, from Rocourt, National Union, and the plaintiff's lawyer. All of them independently and separately reaching consensus on the settlement value of the case. That's what made it negligent to continue on to try to drive down the price. If there wasn't evidence in the record that the case could have been settled, clearly at that point for $6.4 million, and then only later did we settle for less, and then we argued, that would make it a different case. This case has such clear proof of the consensus the parties reached that it did make it negligent to continue. In a case without this kind of proof, you might get to a different result. But the facts are so strong in this case that there was consensus. Normally, I don't think you'd have that kind of contemporaneous proof. But Rocourt did have it in this case.
If National Union was acting as an excess carrier can do and letting the primary carrier handle the defense decisions, would, and this demand had come through, would they have incurred this same liability?
Are you asking me if they hadn't stepped in and taken over
right.
settlement?
If they hadn't canceled the mediation.
I think that would be a different case, and then the MSCOR line of cases would come in. If the excess carrier is standing back waiting for those initial events to trigger its duties, that's a different case. And I'm not arguing to this court that you ought to create such a broad duty that it immediately drags down every excess. But case law is very clear. When you undertake a duty, you've got to act reasonably. And then Stowers is the standard of reasonableness.
Is there any, I know we've had language in Garcia and certainly language in Ranger, but is there any case before that has ever held a carrier liable under this theory that is failing to make a counter demand that led to extra costs of any sort being incurred by the insurer?
Well, I'm not entirely comfortable with you characterizing it that way, and let me suggest how I would characterize it, if I may. But no, there's not a case exactly like this. Garcia and the cases that have wrestled with and tried to define Ranger still talk about a duty to settle, and that's all we're talking about in this case, is a duty to settle. In the normal Stowers case, your delay extends beyond the excess judgment. At that point, all those insurance companies are more than happy to pay the policy limits. That's the delay till after the judgment. In this case, it was still delay, but to a shorter point. So it's not that different. It's still about a delay and failing to settle. And so we have the core Stowers duty, even as recognized by Garcia. I'm not trying to persuade y'all to go way far out and recognize some new free-floating duty to negotiate or some duty to initiate offers. I'm saying under the duty to settle and to be reasonable in doing that, if Stowers is a general negligence standard, we should have recovery. What I'd like to talk about in the second half is all the statutory reasons you don't have to get into that quagmire.
We'll hear opening on that. Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court. I think it is kind of odd that he opened on the issue we brought to the court and I'm opening on his issue, but nevertheless, there we are. And I will talk about the insurance code issue first. Rocor's argument, as I understand it in their briefs, is that they get to bring this unfair claim settlement practice claim because Article 2121 refers to board orders, and one of those, 18663, refers to 2121-2, and they do this in corporations theory, which this court in Watson flatly rejected. This court in Watson rejected that for two very good reasons.
Well, is this, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is an unfair claim settlement practice allegation that's been made, brought by an insured against an insurer. Correct?
That is true.
Well, and didn't we say in Watson that Vail still controls in that situation?
That is one of the sentences in Watson that this court needs to correct, because I do not believe that the court meant that Vail is the law when you're dealing with liability insurance.
But Watson was so, I mean, wasn't all of Watson's premise about the difficulty an insurance company would have if there was an independent duty to a person making a claim against their policyholder? I mean, we talk about all the fiduciary duties that were set up in Arnold. And what in Watson indicated that it was saying anything about an insurance company's relationship with its insurer?
Well, the language in Watson that I'm relying on is at pages 148 and 149, where the court talks about the legislative history. The legislature had rejected an attempt to make a private cause of action for the unfair claim settlement practices in 1991. And this court noted that and said that they were not, this court was not going to permit this kind of cause of action where the legislature had rejected it. What the court obviously knew but did not say in Watson is what I have handed out, or had handed out by the marshals. And that is, in fact, the legislature did adopt in 1991 in the second called session a private cause of action for one very specific thing in 2121-2. And that's at part two of this. It's the typeface that comes off the computer rather than out of the book. And at page two of part two, there is this paragraph that says, if the insurance company asks the claimant for his or her federal income tax return when they shouldn't do it, with some exceptions, that's a violation not only of this section, but of the DTPA. Now, that creates a private cause of action under the DTPA. The DTPA, at this time, also incorporated board orders, which the insurance code did, too. So if the legislature had believed that this 2121-2 that they were amending was going to be actionable in a private cause of action because of reference by board orders, this language making the specific private cause of action for this one subsection was superfluous. And under the statutory rules of interpretation and the doctrine of the expression of one excludes the other, this is just more proof that Watson was correct in its statutory interpretation, which I say was not limited to the fact that Mrs. Watson happened to be a third-party claimant.
Well, you happen to be. Wasn't that the essence of the Watson case? Watson was a third-party claimant, was not the insured, and was arguing that because of the use of the word person, any person, that a claim could be made under 2121 toward the insurance company that was the insurer of someone else. And the whole impetus of Watson was to say there'd be conflicting duties arising and that this should not be permitted to create that conflicting duty. Now, where's the conflicting duty here?
Well,
where is the conflicting duty with the insured and the insurer and someone else?
There is that, not that kind of conflicting duty, but I don't believe that this court in Watson was purporting to tell the legislature what was a person and what was not a person. And I don't believe that this court undertook to say, well, there can be a private cause of action for some people but not others, because that would fly in the face of the statutory interpretation that's embedded and expressed right here in Watson. The,
let me ask you a question. Yeah. Here's an insurer that has the control over how much money would be paid for liability, but the insured, by their contract, by the premiums that are paid, whatever, has agreed that they will handle the defense of the matter. So they will do the defense of the case. Does the insurer have any duty whatsoever to their insured in handling the processing of the case?
If the insured is bearing the defense obligation, no, Your Honor. The insurance company, in that scenario, has taken on one duty, and that is the duty to pay.
Now, if the insurance company says, we will take on the duty to negotiate the settlement, then what duty do they have the insured that the insured has when the insured has retained the right to prepare the case for trial?
Well, if you're talking about a specific contractual provision, then I would want to look at that. But if you're talking about making analogy to what happened here, that ROCOR had the full defense obligation, and yet they claim National Union came in to try to take over settlement negotiations, which I think is a stretch of the record. But in that circumstance, if National Union came in and excluded everybody else from settlement negotiations, then they probably have some duty. But it's not a Stowers duty, because there
is
no Stowers
duty. What is the duty then?
Well, you know, I think that their duty would be to resolve this matter and pay the judgment when there is one, because there's no room in this kind of scenario for another duty to be imposed. If the if the contract right and the Stowers right are not enough, I'm not sure what is. And my opponent says that, well, you know, we're not asking for some kind of free-ranging duty, but that's exactly what they're asking for. They're
well, this could be a breach of contract. Let's take your scenario, which is all we have is an obligation to pay for their liability, and they have the duty to defend. So they think they can settle for 6.5, and they make a demand on you to pay 6.5, and you refuse to pay, and they incur an additional $120,000 in expenses until you finally do pay. It'd just be a breach of contract, and that's what we ought to be arguing about then.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and it's especially right in this case because in Delaney, this court set out what creates a tort duty and what creates a contract cause of action. And if you look at the damages that are claimed here, they're contract damages. Why are they contract damages? Because the contract specifically talks about defense costs.
But isn't the theory of your opponent in this case that they, in fact, took on a duty that they were not required to have under the contract?
Well, I
this
believe
it's an additional duty as opposed to an effort to put a different spin on the same duty. That by taking over exclusive control like they did,
Well, let me address the exclusive control for a minute.
Well, now answer my question first, if you would, about whether or not the position is that this is a different duty, an additional duty.
Well, I believe what I heard him say just now is that it has to be a Stowers duty because he's recognizing what this court said in Head, and that is that there is only one tort duty in this context, and that is Stowers. So I believe he's trying to make a Stowers duty out of it.
And that's a duty that's outside the insurance contract.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so we have separate duty, a tort duty and a contract duty then.
That's correct.
Is it your position here that there was a breach, there could have been a breach of contract had it been pled and tried to the jury?
No, what I was about to say is because the contract puts the defense costs on Roll Corps, that's the reason they didn't bring a contract claim, is because they specifically negotiated for this type of coverage.
Let me ask you, in this situation, let's say that you got a demand within policy limits, everybody agrees that it's reasonable and it should be paid. Under your scenario, is there any incentive for the excess to ever pay timely? I mean, wouldn't it always be in the excess's interest to just wait and make interest on that money? What incentive would they have to settle cases early?
Well, first of all, any interest they would make would be offset by prejudgment interest, but more importantly, the market forces have told excess insurance carriers and insurance carriers generally that claims get worse and more expensive as time goes on.
How would prejudgment interest kick in if you've got a settlement offer that's ultimately accepted? Let's say $6.3 million is offered and you sit on it for 3 years and you settle it for $6.3 million at the end of 3 years. There's no incentive for you to pay it timely.
Well, the incentive to pay is the fear that the claim will get worse and will get more expensive as time goes on. If there's a, you know, if an insured wants to buy a policy that has a duty to defend and has primary coverage throughout this $10 million limit, that type of policy is available.
But is your answer then there is no incentive to settle early?
No. The incentive to settle early is to keep to
Couldn't you just say, okay, we've got, they'll settle for 6.3. Let's wait a while and just see. I don't think they're not going to go up. We'll just sit on that offer for a while and wait a year or so. I mean, that's the problem here, isn't it? That there's no incentive for the excess to come to the table and make a timely offer.
Well, the incentive for the excess is that the claim is going to get worse and more expensive as time goes on. The other incentive is that this court in the judicial administration rules has told trial courts to take cases to trial within 18 months. And once there's a judgment, the excess carrier is not going to have any choice. If you're talking about the hypothetical excess carrier that's sitting out there with its doors barred and is not responding to anything, what we have here is a true irony, and that is that an insurance excess carrier who tries to get involved in a system settlement with no complaint about that part of it is being criticized for delay.
Let me go back to the statutory morass.
Yes.
Let's suppose Vail was the last writing on this, and there's no Watson or Soriano or anything else. Under Vail, would Roll Corps have a claim?
I think under Vail, Roll Corps would have a claim.
Now, did the legislature... Vail, to me, was rather breathtaking in its ingenuity, and I dissented, but there it was. I was only dissenting. Did the legislature do anything in response to Vail?
Well, I don't recall that the amendments to these codes came in 1991. I don't believe they responded directly. But Vail, as you know, has a free alternative.
The only argument that Roll Corps no longer has a statutory claim is our reinterpretation, as it were, of this whole scheme in Watson.
Well, it's not quite limited to that. To say that Vail would say that they can get to 2121-2. Then you'd have to ask yourself the question, is the old 2121-2 designed to apply to liability carriers? That's a serious question that I don't think anybody has answered, because if you look at 2121...
So even under Vail?
Even under Vail, it's incorporated, but then the question is, okay, what does this statute mean to apply to liability carriers? And doesn't, if it did, wouldn't this section about not making a settlement offer presuppose a duty to make settlement offers, that is a duty to defend, which is the normal situation? So there's even if you can get incorporated through Vail, there's no saying that 2121-2 would even apply to excess carriers or to liability carriers.
Now, does that situation change by the duties that your client voluntarily assumed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because we have a contractual right to get involved in settlement. Of course, it's our policy that's being called upon. So what we did was appoint a lawyer to get involved and negotiate. It's not as though this case sat dormant for 9 months, all ready to settle. The depositions of the truck driver and the plaintiff's experts and the defendant's corporate officials had not been taken. A lot of discovery was going on. And I think National Union had the right to try to negotiate to save something off the $10 million that had been demanded.
Why should bail not apply to liability insurance?
Well, because if bail applies to liability insurance, then you're going to have to take back Head, and you're going to take back Soriano, and you're going to undo about 6 years of this court's decisions.
But bail, it's based on bail. Assuming bail was our last case.
Right. Why? Okay.
Why wouldn't it apply to liability carriers?
Well,
I understand your excess argument.
Okay.
Justice Hankinson has the question. Why?
Well, there's three subparts of bail, and I'm at the moment remembering two of them. One is that through these board orders, one of those board orders says anything prohibited by law, and Arnold and Aranda had prohibited this conduct by law, and therefore this was an insurance code violation under bail. Well, Arnold and Aranda and bail should not apply to third party or to liability cases because that's inconsistent with the Stauer Doctrine, as this court did say in Head, which I'm supposed to be ignoring for the moment. But it is inconsistent with the Stowers Doctrine. In fact, Stowers, I'll say this like I'm making it up and you hadn't said it before, yeah. Stowers is more strict on the insurance company than the duty of good faith.
Why is it inconsistent with Stowers? Why is bail inconsistent with Stowers?
The duty of good faith and fair dealing, which I think is what part of bail you're talking about, is inconsistent with Stowers.
I'm talking about statutory interpretation.
You're talking about the statutory interpretation.
Okay. You said that bail, meaning right. The statutory interpretation piece, as I understood it, should not apply to liability carriers. And my question is, why not?
Right, because if you're talking about the part of bail that says we're going to go to 2121-2, right, it's because 2121-2, as it existed in 1990 at the time of this case or even at bail, did not indicate whether it was supposed to apply to liability insurance, and it does not look like it was supposed to apply because there's none of the provisions that we now have in the 1995 amendments in the unfair claim settlement practice part of 2121 that talk about reservation rights letters and those kind of things that are involved in liability insurance. If you take this 2121-2, settle in good faith, and move it into liability insurance, you've done the same thing as taking Arnold and Aranda and putting it in the context.
But if the legislature intended that by putting the good faith settlement requirement, the reasonable efforts to settle in the statute, then why wouldn't we be required to follow the legislative intent?
Well,
I mean, you're going over into the common law area and saying we shouldn't import that, but if the legislature has included a requirement of reasonable efforts and good faith to settle, why then wouldn't that control?
Well, the legislature had not done that at the time we're talking about because 2121-2 did not create a private cause of action. It was something the board could pursue when it was done frequently. It had the frequency requirement in there as well. But, this failure to attempt to settle in good faith when liability has become reasonably clear, National Union did not fail to attempt to settle in this case. We made many settlement overtures. We made many attempts, and they were ultimately successful.
Let me ask you this. You say that there is an easy answer to this case or to this problem, and that is for insureds not to enter into this kind of contract. The way they should handle it is to enter into a contract where it's going to be the insurance company is responsible for paying the defense cost. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question, which probably is outside the record, that I'll let the other side respond to. How common are these kinds of contracts? Is this the common way that insurance is handled with commercial facilities like this, or is it more common for them to enter into contracts where it's the insurance company picking up the defense tab?
This is uncommon in two respects. First of all, for the insurer to bear the defense obligation at all is not the common way, not the way consumers buy insurance, and certainly not the way most businesses do unless they are very practiced in handling lawsuits. It's uncommon in the second way because the normal self-insured retention provides that the defense costs erode the limits. And in that kind of circumstance, the excess carrier is going to end up paying the expenses if it goes into his layer because the limits of the underlying have been eroded. But I think it's important that we focus on what kind of insurance that Rocor intentionally bought. Their man, Mr. Arzaga, testified at trial that he did cost-benefit analysis. He knew about insurance. He was a risk manager. And he decided to get this kind of insurance for several reasons. One, to save costs on premiums. Two, to have control over the lawyers. He wanted to be able to select the lawyers. Three, he wanted to have control over the case and the settlement of the case. So why now, in this first case that Rocor ever had that went into the excess, and they see the implications of the kind of insurance that they bought, are we being asked to relieve them of the bargain that they made? So the, you know, which raises the great legal argument, a deal is a deal. And I think that this court ought to give credence to the kind of contract that Rocor...
But they're not suing on the contract. They're suing on the tort.
That's true. And in every case that I've had where there is a contract between the parties and the plaintiff is not suing on the contract, it raises a great question in my mind of why not, especially as in this case where the contract addresses the conduct that's at issue. So the fact that they're not bringing a contract claim only tells us this much, is that they recognize they don't have a breach of contract claim. And
but that doesn't mean that they don't have a tort claim.
It doesn't mean they don't have a tort claim.
I'm a little confused. You, in answer to some questions, you kept answering in the vein of duty of good faith and fair dealing, and you cited Head. But Head says clearly that this court recognizes a Stowers claim is not a bad faith claim. And opposing counsel says you can fit this, although it's not totally round in a square hole, that into a Stowers situation. And that his view is that the damages that arise in a Stowers situation, at least thus far, are the carrier has to pay excess damages. And his comment was, but that doesn't mean if you have a failure to timely settle, which is not a bad faith claim, but a Stowers claim, why can't the damages be the additional defense costs that were incurred because of his assertion your company, for whatever reason, took over the settlement and delayed more than a year when everybody knew what the value of the case was?
Here's the reason, and I'm not saying that there's no tort duty. I'm saying there's no tort duty under other than Stowers. But the reason that this will not work to grant this particular relief to Rocor is that there is no way to distinguish between this case and the next case that comes along where the insurance company has a duty to defend but does not settle quickly enough for the insured's liking, and the insured sues for the inconvenience of having the lawsuit be pending, the financial damage to the company because of this contingent liability, mental anguish, or whatever. So you're being asked to expand the Stowers duty, which will apply not only in this case, but in every other case, even in the normal insurance situation, where the insurance company is bearing the defense costs, for a delay in settlement. Stowers is a draconian remedy meant to apply in strict circumstances where the insurance company says we're not going to accept this limits demand and goes on and there's an excess judgment.
But then how do you explain Ranger and Garcia and those cases?
Well, Ranger versus Wynn has been trimmed down twice, first in Garcia and second in Traver. As Justice Phillips said in the opinion in Traver, we have said before that Wynn is only a Stowers case, and the rest of Wynn's language is dicta. I believe this court could, you know, perhaps go further and make that clear, but it's clear enough to me that nobody ought to be relying on Gwynn unless they've got a true Stowers case, in which case I'd be more likely to rely on Garcia.
So if there had been a written offer, in this case, to settle by the plaintiffs, to settle for $6.3 million back at the time the $10 million offer was made, and there was a year delay before it settled, would there be a Stowers claim or not?
I don't think that National Union as an excess carrier with no duty to defend can be Stowerized in that circumstance.
So even if there had been a $4 million offer, then you'd settle for $6.3 and it cost whatever amount. That, there's still no cause of action because that's not their money.
That's right.
Maybe I'm confused. Is it your position that the Stowers duty is only implicated if the demand equals what the settlement value of the case is?
No, Your Honor.
The demand has to be made within policy limits, and the demand, there was written demand within the policy limits of the excess carrier in this case.
That is correct, although this court has never held and has expressly reserved opinion, I think, in Garcia in a footnote, about how you Stowerize carriers when there's multiple layers. So there's no holding from this court that ever says if the total of all the insurance available is $10 million and you send a $10 million demand, you Stowerized everybody. It's more complicated than that. But I don't think that National Union can be Stowerized.
But you're not arguing there was no Stowers here because the demand was not in the same amount as what it settled for. That's not your point.
Correct. That's not my point.
Any other questions? Thank you.
If I may, let me start by responding to Justice Abbott's question. These are very common with bigger insured businesses because it's becoming more and more common in my practice and experience to see that larger insureds, more sophisticated companies like Rocor, would prefer to have that first $1 million worth of coverage or retention and the ability to control their own destiny. So these are fairly common.
Why shouldn't they be held to their agreement then and make them pay the defense costs?
That same question could be asked about Stowers. You chose a certain policy limit. You did the cost-benefit analysis that led you to choose that policy limit. Why shouldn't you be held to that deal? Well, the answer in Stowers is because you're entitled to reasonable performance of the insurance company's obligations. And that's what Rocor was entitled to, reasonable performance of the insurance company's obligations. When we do the cost-benefit analysis and we choose a contract that imposes on us defense costs, we're entitled to assume reasonable performance by the excess insurer. They won't unreasonably inflict extra defense costs on us. Just like every other insurer, when they get a certain policy limit, they're entitled to expect reasonable performance, that the insurance company won't negligently expose them to risk beyond that.
But suppose they had talked. Suppose they had sat down, Rocor and National Union, and said, now look, Rocor says, we think you can settle this for way under $10 million. And we want you to do it and be done with this. And National Union says, well, we think the price will go down if you'll go do your job and get ready for trial. And Rocor says, well, we think it won't. And National Union says, well, we can't tell yet. And so they would just agree to disagree, and they do have to get ready for trial, and they don't settle for a while. We're going to retry that case then to decide if the insurer acted reasonably under your scenario.
Well, if we had those facts, it would be a more difficult case because then I think you posited a good faith, legitimate disagreement. And I think your argument would be, or the insurance company's argument would be, we were wrong, perhaps, but we weren't unreasonable. That's inherent in Stowers and that's inherent in the statute.
But that's a jury trial in every one of these cases.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, some facts are so weak they're just not going to get there. But when we have a statute that talks about failing to act in good faith to effectuate a prompt, fair, and equitable settlement, and we have a negligence duty that says reasonableness, fact questions are just inevitable. And we can't write the law to deny relief so much that we never have a jury trial.
Well, let's talk about the statute for a minute. 2121-2, Section 4, it talks about settlement of claims submitted. To me, that clearly indicates a first-party claim because a third party doesn't submit a claim under a policy. Similarly, in 5, it talks about compelling policyholders to institute suits to recover amounts due under its policies when you've offered substantially less than what's due under the policy. Again, that implies to me that we're talking about first-party insurance, not third-party liability claims.
I would love to talk to you about the statute because I think quite candidly the court wrestled with the Stowers duty and the Ranger phrasing of it in Garcia so much. I think we're right under Stowers. I think this case with these facts and this contemporaneous proof, we ought to win under Stowers. But you're going to have to write a very careful opinion to make sure it doesn't get out of hand in future cases where there's less proof. One way is to say, well, no, there's got to be written proof of the 6.4. That'd be a new proof requirement that didn't exist before. But you're going to have to be so careful that if I can persuade you that we win under the statute, you don't need to get there. And I think clearly we do for this reason. And if I can kind of give you some context, Your Honor, to answer your question, Vail really is the starting point, and it was convoluted. I think you're now the only remaining member of the court that was here when it got written. But it was convoluted by necessity. The statute said unfair insurance practices are prohibited when they're defined in Section 4, which had a few definitions, when they're defined in Section 1746 of the DDPA, A and B, which was controversial, and rules and regulations. And so you had to go through this, you know, maze of rules and regulations, and the court did a very thorough job in Vail. Here's the good news. Your paper's been graded. In Watson, you came along, and I think the court's been very clear in saying Watson was about the rights of a third-party claimant. Watson itself said, we're not changing Vail with respect to insurance rights. Well, then in 95, the legislature came along. You had recognized in Vail a cause of action under 2121-2 for failing to act in good faith to settle one's liability is reasonably clear. That language, that long sentence, that had been embraced. Watson came along and said, Bell's still the good law if it's an insured. We're an insured. We still fit. In 1995, the legislature amended 2121 and said you were right in Vail and you were right in Watson. Look at Section 410. Which is now the unfair settlement practices. They adopted exactly the same definition. What they did, the legislature felt uncomfortable about rules and regulations. A state agency being able to give a treble damage cause of action was a big concern for the legislature. So what they did is they picked the ones they agreed with from Vail and lifted them up into the statute and then took rules and regulations out. In Section 410, what they also did is they agreed with you on third-party claimants. They said, Watson is right to the extent of not opening the door to third-party claimants. So at the beginning of Section 410 and at the end, they make it very, very clear this is insureds and beneficiaries. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. In Section 410, when they talk about one of the items being failing to act in good faith to settle, another item is failing to tender a reservation of rights letter. That's only third-party. How can you read this statute in a way that doesn't embrace liability insurance in light of that language? Also, this court's been very diligent lately in Castile and Garrison Contractors about trying to apply the statute by its own terms. And I think that was your point. Well, this is a statutory duty we're dealing with. It is. The statute talks about any insurer. Article 2121-2, Justice Owens, says any insurer. It doesn't say any first-party insurer. You have to interpret into it meaning that's not plainly there. When they said any insurer, that's what they meant. And in 95, when they tried to sort out Watson and Bell, they fully embraced applying 2121 to third-party insurance, liability insurance. Why not? You don't have to worry about conflicts between different common law duties because it's a statutory duty. Bell set it out. Look what this court has done with Bell. Watson says Bell's still a good law for insurance. And Faircloth decided shortly after that, you characterized Watson as being third-party claimants and Vail being insured, which Rocor's an insured. Then in Provident, which you wrote, Justice Owen, you specifically went back and noted that failing to act in good faith to settle was a cause of action viable under 2121.
But again, if you look at the failure to settle pieces of Section 410, again under Section 4. The ones that talk about settlement failure to settle, to me, again, seem to be talking in terms of first party, not third party.
Here's where that reasoning would get the court to. And I don't disagree. It doesn't plainly say liability insurance, and it doesn't plainly say first party insurance. I like the words any insurer. There's other language. It's not the clearest thing because they weren't writing this for a private cause of action. They were writing 2121 for a private cause of action. And it talks about any insurer. That's where the cause of action comes from. This is just a definition, and that's what Vail said. But let's say the court were to write an opinion that says, well, the old 2121-2 only applies to first-party claims, not third-party. You'd have this anomaly. Prior to 95, liability insurance would be excluded from this definition under 2121. But after 95, when they adopt this laundry list that includes reservation of rights, things that clearly point to
I'm not saying that the whole statute doesn't. I'm saying the piece that you're relying upon.
And that's what I'm saying. You would have this
settlement practices.
You'd have this weird anomaly. How would courts and practitioners go through line by line in 2121, which admittedly must apply to liability insurance, and say, well, this section doesn't, this section doesn't, this section does, this section doesn't. The legislature in 95 said, we're comfortable with this statute applying to liability insurance. That's not a problem. We're uncomfortable.
Where's the legislative history that says that?
It is apparent from the language of the statute itself, and I assume there are committee reports, but the language itself is very clear on embracing Vail as setting the standards of liability for insureds, and Watson is saying who gets to be a plaintiff. The legislature agreed with Watson and Vail in that regard. And they didn't take the opportunity then to say, but not liability insurance. To the contrary, they adopted a prohibition that clearly points to liability insurance. There's no good reason to construe or misconstrue the statute to try to keep liability insurance out. This case is a good example. These people who needed the benefits were delayed in getting them, even though the defendant, Rocor, didn't disagree. Rocor was faced, the record is clear, with a potential judgment. 2121. But after 95, when they adopt this laundry list that includes reservation of rights, things that clearly point to
I'm not saying that the whole statute doesn't. I'm saying the piece that you're relying upon.
And that's what I'm saying. You would have this
settlement practices.
You'd have this weird anomaly. How would courts and practitioners go through line by line in 2121, which admittedly must apply to liability insurance, and say, well, this section doesn't, this section doesn't, this section does, this section doesn't. The legislature in 95 said, we're comfortable with this statute applying to liability insurance. That's not a problem. We're uncomfortable.
Where's the legislative history that says that?
It is apparent from the language of the statute itself, and I assume there are committee reports, but the language itself is very clear on embracing Vail as setting the standards of liability for insureds, and Watson is saying who gets to be a plaintiff. The legislature agreed with Watson and Vail in that regard. And they didn't take the opportunity then to say, but not liability insurance. To the contrary, they adopted a prohibition that clearly points to liability insurance. There's no good reason to construe or misconstrue the statute to try to keep liability insurance out. This case is a good example. These people who needed the benefits were delayed in getting them, even though the defendant, Rocor, didn't disagree. Rocor was faced, the record is clear, with a potential judgment of $20 million. It would be extremely difficult for a company to withstand that kind of hit. The statutory path is very clear. I've laid it out, I hope, in a more clear, more linear fashion in the briefing. And I'd ask you to consider that and perhaps avoid having to get to the negligence issue until some other day.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments in this morning's causes, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez.